Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Author Scott DePalma writes for the consumer magazine industry. His memoir, Grandson of a Ghost, explores the repercussions of his grandfather's suicide, coming out as a gay man in the 80s, and finding balance after enduring severe abuse. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Scott about his work. Scott, welcome to Fully Booked.
Oh, thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
You originally intended to publish your book as a novel, but decided to call it a memoir. Why did you decide to make that change?
Publishing it as a novel was initially a layer of deception. I wanted to add an additional layer, and I just, once I finished the book, felt more confident about just taking away that layer and calling it a memoir. I was kind of hiding behind it.
And how do you think moving to New York City in the 80s from Vermont helped shape your trajectory?
Well, it definitely made me feel kind of like an outsider and kind of like shy and on my own, which is actually a big part of the book. Not really having a support network here and being kind of like from a rural background actually went with my whole narrative of keeping to myself and hiding from the world.
And why did you decide to write Grandson of a Ghost?
I actually entered therapy, and it turned out to be something I discussed with my therapist as a good exercise for me that would allow me to get back to creative writing, which I desperately missed. And also I needed to really kind of dig out things from my past in a way that would go deeper than I dared to go to talking face to face in his office.
And do you think that the writing process changed or shaped the way that you perceive your past?
It definitely helped me to make it concrete and to allow me to put it into an actual order of how things, one thing led to another, which is actually a big theme of the book and a big part of my therapy. I did feel like, how could things have really mattered when I was little? And the book itself helped me to really put down on paper how one thing leads to another. Being very young, you don't have a frame of reference, and next thing you know, you've developed a low self-esteem that you've never been able to shake.
And do you think in writing this book, has it helped free you at all?
Yes, it's allowed me to compartmentalize, and that I put it into this book. I can refer to it myself, wondering how, if things really mattered or not. And it just is a good touchstone for me, mm-hmm. psychologically, and just it's physical and emotional.
All right, Scott. Well, thanks so much for talking with us about your memoir. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find Scott DePalma's book, Grandson of a Ghost, at Amazon.com and select independent bookstores.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
In many ways, the challenge now today is, well, how do we reconcile these norms that are so critical for our democracy with the racially diverse and, you know, and our goals of political equality for all people?
You could be forgiven if you assumed a book whose title is How Democracies Die is a dire read. But one of the things that has made the book a national bestseller is that it's not dire. There's actually hope in this book. This week, we're talking to one of the book's co-authors, Daniel Ziblatt. Like his co-author, Stephen Levitsky, Ziblatt is a professor of government at Harvard. He's also the author of a book titled Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy, and we're glad to have him on this week's episode. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm curious, how long before Trump was elected president did you all start writing the book?
So as you mentioned, I had another book that I just completed in 2017 called Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy, and that book was really a historical book on themes of democratization. And so I'd been working on these topics for 10 years, probably, in writing that book. And my co-author, Steve, as well, has, you know, been working on these topics for a long time. We both teach on democracies and regimes and authoritarianism, both graduate courses and undergraduate courses. So in some sense, we've been working on the book for, you know, 15, 20 years. But in terms of this, the actual book itself, really, I guess the project began during the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, as we were listening to the presidential campaign and the tenor of politics. And as, you know, we heard things, you know, during the campaign, you know, accusing, especially during the general election, but even during the primary season, you know, accusing, you know, threats to lock up Hillary Clinton. And I think it was October 2016 debate where candidate Trump said he wouldn't necessarily accept the results of the election. We began to think we really needed to work on this topic because we had really studied other parts of the world, but for the first time thought that our knowledge would be relevant for studying the United States as well.
Yeah, because I'm interested in this because I asked because, you know, one of the important points in this book, I mean, first of all, there's this idea sort of undergirding the whole thing that American democracy is weakening. And you all actually say that Trump is not the cause of that, but sort of more of a symptom. And so you didn't really write this book just because or after Trump became president.
No, really. I mean, as you know, speaking for myself, I mean, this book that I wrote on conservative parties, I had come to the realization, and that book is very historical. And then the preface I make mentioned of the current politics, but it's really a historical book. But in working on that book, Steve and I both had conversations about this with each other, that we had this idea that when a conservative party or one of the mainstream parties in a political system begins to abandon democratic norms or becomes radicalized, that one of the kind of two key pillars of the political system is broken, and this actually damages the political system as a whole. And so there was kind of a temptation, I think, for many people to think, you know, looking, let's say, at California, where the Democratic Party, you know, has dominated politics for a long time now, that, you know, that's a good thing. The more the Republicans kind of disintegrate or degenerate in some way, that this is maybe good if you're a Democrat. But we really had the view that actually you need two competing viable parties. And so we were already alert to this issue. We were alert to the kind of problems of polarization that this was generating. And so then when the election happened, we really thought, aha, this is happening much more quickly than we expected it would. I guess that was the main point. We sort of thought this is this long-run problem. We didn't expect to suddenly be confronted with the problem so immediately. We were thinking, like, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the road, the U.S. would be facing a kind of crisis that it turns out, you know, maybe is facing today.
Right, right. And so was the title of the book always going to be How Democracies Die?
Yeah, you know, we sort of, like, you know, it's hard to remember how we came up with the title. At some point we had How Democracies Die, and as academics, perhaps, we had a much longer subtitle, How Democracies Die and Something, 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 Something. Mm-hmm. But no, you know, that was always somewhere in the title. But we, you know, kept trimming away and realized that was the essence of it.
Yeah. Because it is certainly, I mean, it's a marvel of clarity.
Yeah.
But it is a dire sounding title.
Well, you know, I mean, the book is really, I mean, we intend it. I mean, there's two broad kind of global points. One, that the way democracies die has changed over time. And, you know, during the Cold War, they tended to die through military coups. And since the collapse of communism, this is what we both have studied, in Steve in particular, new forms of authoritarianism have emerged in which people get elected, so have the mantle of legitimacy of election that elections give a politician. But then once in office, begin to dismantle democratic institutions, or at least hack democratic institutions. And so our goal was really to point out that global phenomena, and to then think about how this would be relevant or not relevant in the case of the U.S. And we really, I mean, we try to be very sober and grounded and not, you know, make extreme claims that the U.S. is following the fate of other democracies in crisis. In many ways, the U.S. is much more robust democracy, much older democracy, much richer democracy. There's many reasons to think that we will muddle through all of this. But in a way, the point is to draw lessons from other countries as warnings to the U.S.
So I want to ask about these two concepts that are pretty crucial in this book and that are also crucial, you say, for a healthy democracy. And the terms are mutual toleration and forbearance. Could you just say a little bit about what you mean by those ideas?
Yeah, so we, you know, there's a lot of talk about norms being assaulted every day. And so as we were thinking about this, we kind of want, you know, there's lots of small norms that don't really matter very much. I mean, we sometimes jokingly say, you know, that President Trump is the first president in a long time not to have a dog, but, you know, that really doesn't matter very much for our democracy.
Right.
So, but, you know, so there's some norms that matter and some more norms that don't. And at some level, we, I mean, in a way, I'm not sure, I forget if this term is in the book, but the way we thought about this is we call these meta norms, in some sense, kind of the most important norms underpinning our political system are these two norms of mutual toleration and forbearance. And so what the idea is that our political system doesn't operate as any system just by the written rule alone. I mean, the way people have coped with written rules throughout all facets of life, in the workplace and sports and families and everywhere, is in, as well as in politics, is to develop kind of ways of doing things that if you violate them, you feel some sanction of punishment of, you know, finger wagging or whatever. You know, you feel some cost to breaking unwritten rules. And those are what norms are. And so these two norms, mutual toleration and forbearance, are particularly important and I think drive a lot of what makes our American democracy stable, or has historically. So the first one, mutual toleration, means basically the idea that you accept your political rivals as legitimate contenders for power, and you treat them as rivals, as competitors, not as enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that we kind of take for granted, and it seems kind of obvious. But you know, the idea that you go to extreme measures to prevent somebody from coming to power. If you thought they were an enemy, you'd go to extreme measures, right? But if you think somebody, you know, just disagrees with you, but and you may even dislike the person or the political party, the other political party, but at some level, each side has a legitimate right to govern. And this is an invention, really, that we sometimes, again, we take it for granted, but. You know, historians have argued, we draw on Richard Hofstadter here, who argues in the U.S. this really only developed in the 1830s in the U.S. Because, you know, if you have the idea in politics that there is some ideal way of organizing your political system and you have figured that out, and there's only one answer, you have the answer. Anybody who challenges that is a threat. And so the idea that, well, actually, maybe I don't have a monopoly on the truth, or my party doesn't have a monopoly on the truth, and that I think I'm right, but I may not be right, then the idea is, well, you need to have competition, political competition, in order to have a functioning political system. And so underpinning, containing political competition in a way is this notion of mutual toleration. So that's the first idea. And a very much related one that's a little less conventional, I think, is the idea that we call forbearance. And forbearance means the self-conscious limiting of the exercise of power. And so there may be certain rights that a president, for instance, can pardon anybody he likes under the Constitution, or anybody he or she likes under the Constitution, or the Congress can hold up any nominee for a cabinet position for any reason they like. Congress can actually impeach a president for any reason they like. All of these things under the written Constitution are perfectly fine. But in order for our political system to work, the norm has developed that politicians step back from the brink from time to time. And so that's the second big norm. And these two things are certainly related. But without these, our political system is really a dysfunctional system.
Yeah. And you know, for people who are sort of anguished by the sort of political tenor in this country right now, I mean, your book is comforting in one sense, I guess, because there have been moments in American history when those norms of mutual toleration and forbearance haven't really worked. And obviously, one of those moments is the years leading up to the Civil War. But the interesting thing is that these norms were sort of broken for quite a while after the war, you all say in the book. But at the end of the 19th century, we started to get them back. And I'm curious if you could just, to give people a little bit of hope, what happened so that we started to get those norms back?
So we make the case that both in the 1790s and the founding, I mean, you know, the Federalists and the Republicans really despised each other and treated each other as, you know, as agents of foreign powers. You know, the Federalists thought that the Republicans were agents of the French, and the Republicans thought the Federalists were agents of the British. And so we kind of broke our way out of that. But then the more recent experience of the Civil War, where, you know, there was violence on the floor of Congress before the fighting broke out in battlefields, and, you know, the famous caning of Charles Sumner is only the most famous instance of this. But then through the Civil War and after the Civil War, and there was a, you know, great experiment in democracy and with Reconstruction that ended up ultimately being dismantled at, after 1877 and into the 1890s. And throughout this period, you know, after the Civil War, as one can easily imagine, you know, the Republicans were very happy to accuse Democrats, in particular Southern Democrats, of being treasonous. And, you know, in some sense, for good reason. But, you know, this idea of waving the bloody shirt, you know, was a political technique that was used frequently. So this was the kind of that the late 19th century version of the same kind of politics we have today. Now, the story of how and the history of how this was gradually, you know, became a thing of the past. I mean, partly generational change, you know, as people who'd lived through the Civil War, you know, retired and so on, became less immediately relevant. But one point that we make in the book, in some ways, it's not such a happy story. This history kind of proceeds tragically in a way. I mean, that in many senses, what happened was that as the civil rights agenda and voting rights agenda of the Reconstruction era was moved off the agenda, this allowed for Democrats and Republicans, conservative Republicans and Southern Democrats, to begin to cooperate in ways that the most kind of existentially challenging feature of American politics, race and racial equality, was removed from the agenda. So one of the sort of tragic lessons is, in fact, that the way that our these norms that are so important to our political system, forbearance and mutual toleration, came at the price of racial exclusion. So in many ways, the challenge now today is, well, how do we reconcile these norms that are so critical for our democracy with the racially diverse and, you know, and our goals of political equality for all people? And so, you know, this is a major challenge, in fact. And it's there's reasons to be worried that it won't work. But, you know, we tried, you know, I think there's some reason to be optimistic as well. So it's not an entirely happy story, I guess.
Yeah. But I mean, you all do sort of make the point that there's this sort of deep anxiety about racial change and diversity in this country is kind of fueling the polarization we're experiencing, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. And so that's why, and from our account, I mean, there's many things driving this, but the norm erosion, this kind of that Republicans and Democrats increasingly fear and loathe each other. I mean, there are these figures that we cite that are this quite famous poll now showing that in the 1960s, 5% of Democrats and Republicans, when asked, would you be upset if your son or daughter married somebody of the other party, 4 or 5% said yes. And today that figure is around 50%. So, you know, people, there's in high levels of animosity and fear. I mean, in some ways we don't, you know, most people are aware of this. We argue though that this polarization is driven by more than just fights over taxing and spending and so on. This is driven in many ways by a shift primarily that began really with the Republican Party, that, you know, with the late 1960s, the democratization of the U.S. really, that came with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. This triggered a couple of quick changes or significant changes. One, Southern Democrats became Republicans, and newly enfranchised African Americans gravitated towards the Democratic Party. A new wave of immigration in the 60s, and many of these new immigrants from Latin America and Asia ended up in the Democratic Party. So, you know, whereas up until the 60s, you know, from the end of Reconstruction until the 1960s, you had two very homogeneous parties that looked very similar to each other. That is, after, you know, beginning in the 1960s, but really reaching a peak in the 1990s, you have two very different political parties. One party that's the Republican Party, that's primarily a white Christian party, I mean, with some exceptions, but primarily those are the voters of the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party, which is much more of a rainbow coalition of suburban, urban, secular, and ethnic minorities. And so it's a combination, you know, so that sharp divide has given rise to a highly polarized politics that, so, you know, that really represents a challenge to the U.S. today.
And so to sort of calm things down, I mean, what do you think Republicans should do, and what do you think Democrats should do? And are those things different from one another?
Yeah, there's roles to play for everybody. You know, our challenges are significant enough. I mean, one of the points we make in the book is that the Republican Party really needs to diversify itself. I mean, in a diverse society that we live in today, to have a political party, one political party that's essentially a kind of white Christian party, is just makes the party vulnerable to white nationalist appeals that we've seen recently. Mm-hmm. This in many ways explains the radicalization of the party. So, I mean, what party leaders need to do, and I think many are aware of this, after the recent presidential election, I mean, the Republican Party issue this autopsy, which they, you know, this kind of scathing self-criticism, which they, so the party should embrace immigration and to try to reach out to Latino voters. And this just didn't happen. But this is the kind of thing that I think really does need to happen. The party itself needs to be refounded on a new basis or reach new types of voters. That's one point. And the demographically, in the short run, the party's fine. But in the medium and long run, it needs to do this in order to survive. So that's one crucial point. But there's stuff for Democrats to do as well. I mean, one of the things that we argue in the book is that there's great temptation for Democrats to respond to Republicans with kind of the same kind of norm breaking that we've seen Republicans carry out. And in some instances, Democrats have been doing this. So just to give you an example, you know, with the, one of the kind of most egregious norm violations we argue in recent memory was when the Republican Senate refused to even hold hearings for President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. This was something that hasn't happened since the 1860s. So this is really unprecedented to not even hold hearings. I mean, sometimes people don't get approved, but to not even hold hearings was really unusual. So there's some Democrats now that we talk to who think that this is what Democrats should do if President Trump gets an opportunity. So we call this kind of form of politics of really hard-nosed constitutional hardball, which, you know, is tempting and understandable because the idea is nobody wants to be the sucker and kind of be the one taking the abuse while the and then you know sort of having your hands tied behind your back. But one of the points we make in the book is that when you look around the world, that democracies in crisis often are accompanied by this form of constitutional hardball where there's a spiral. Each side feels it's justified in breaking rules and norms. And we argue the Democratic Party needs to fight hard, needs to stand for principles that it believes in. I mean, we don't think that the you know, we're not arguing for a kind of bland bipartisanship at all. I mean, part of the Democrats need to fight hard for what they believe in, but they need to do so in a way that reinforces norms. So the kind of procedures of democracy need to be reinforced. So that's something that we really think voters could hold their elected officials responsible and accountable for.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, How Democracies Die is a national bestseller. It's been on the Times bestseller list for a while. Obviously, a lot of people have bought your book. I'm curious if you have heard from your readers, you know, feedback from them, and are they people who are not in favor of Trump, or are you finding that people all across the political spectrum are buying your book?
We wrote the book really to not be an anti-Trump book. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said at the beginning, but to try to reach, you know, that we think we have a message both for Republicans and Democrats. And we hoped that people would, you know, read it in that light. I mean, I think, you know, we've gotten feedback from all sorts of people, lots of email, lots of typed up letters from people who presumably don't use email, older people as well. I mean, so that's been really inspiring in a lot of ways. Teachers, you know, high school teachers writing us saying, you know, what can we do in our classroom to, you know, help preserve American democracy? And, you know, often we don't have the answers to these questions, but, you know, so that's been very, and high school students, you know, some of the book signings we've been to, high school students read the book and say, I'm taking an AP American History course and I heard you and I bought the book and I'm really enjoying it. And so that's been really, you know, inspiring. And in a lot of, you know, some of the events we've gone to and, you know, public library and, you know, and other events, public events, you know, people are very engaged. And so that's given, I think both of us, and I know for me for sure, a kind of renewed optimism that there's people are engaged and not sort of taking our crisis lightly, the crisis of American democracy. In terms of reaching Trump supporters, I mean, we haven't had as much success. I mean, I hope Republicans would read our book. And you know, we've had some people say, well, the first half is really good, which deals with Europe and Latin America from the 30s to the 70s. But when you get to the U.S., it's not so great. And so, you know, I think, and, you know, what's interesting is they'll some people have said, well, you know, this shows you the part is the polarized nature of our politics, that even these very smart guys can't get out of their Democratic, you know, party angle. And, you know, my response to that is, well, that shows you how polarized we are, that even very smart readers can't get out of their partisan angle to see, you know, that we are, you know, we are really making an argument, I think, that should appeal to many Republicans. You know, these arguments about forbearance are, you know, we think are, you know, once Democrats, if Democrats retake the House and the Senate in the fall, Republicans and President Trump are going to be facing very angry Democrats. And what we're counseling is that Democrats need to restrain themselves and to kind of to sustain our democratic politics. So this should be a message that, in fact, that Republicans and anybody really who's interested in the survival of our democracy should take seriously. So, you know, we continue to hope that we will find readers across the spectrum, because we think the message in this sense, you know, we have our own personal angles on politics, but we think we're again making a book that's written a book that's pro-democracy, you know, with a small d, not necessarily anti-Trump.
Well, it's a fascinating read. It's called How Democracies Die, and thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Wow, Clay, mutual tolerance and forbearance. I've always considered that to be our policy here at Fully Booked, but I never had words to put on it.
Well, now you do. And not only is it our policy on Fully Booked, but it's really the way that the country should be run. But as Daniel was saying, unfortunately, it's really not.
Yes. And unfortunately, he was not my social studies teacher in high school, because I feel like I would have learned a lot more.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's fascinating. This book is, you know, it's written by these two, you know, very sort of expert professors, but it's very accessible. And in a way, I mean, it's sort of a re-education, you know, I think it's why it's become this big bestseller. You know, people are really flocking to it. They sort of want to, I guess, be re-educated about how American democracy should function. And there's also a fascinating history in it too. I mean, as I said, about the Civil War and revolutionary days.
I mean, hopefully that re-education can lead to reunification, because I was shocked to hear that figure, you know, that 50% of people surveyed now say they would have a problem if their child brought home a spouse of the opposing party. It used to be like 5% 50 years ago. Was that roughly the numbers? Wow.
Yeah, it's intense. You know. Ugh. Anyway, but it's a great read.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Hi, I'm Spencer Raskoff, the CEO of Zillow Group. And I have a new podcast here on Podcast One called Office Hours. Listen as I have one-on-one conversations with other CEOs. We have the kind of conversations that can only happen between peers, tackling tough questions, sharing hard-won insights, and helping to define what leadership means today. Join me twice a month on Office Hours, exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the new Podcast One app.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So who are you talking to?
I'm talking to a debut author, Dr. Daniela Lamas.
Oh, right. We're excited to talk to her. All right. Well, let's call her up.
Let's. In the terrifying moments of a major medical crisis, we rely on our physician's skills and judgment to save our lives. And living through it is almost always seen as a triumph. In You Can Stop Humming Now, A Doctor's Stories of Life, Death, and In-Between, Dr. Daniela Lamas presents patients whose lives were extended by high-level interventions enabled by advances in medical technology. People coping with the at-times extraordinary difficulties of recovery and self-care. According to Kirkus, this beautifully written debut is, quote, an enthralling reminder that behind every medical advance are the people whose lives it affects and that their stories have impact. Dr. Lamas is a pulmonary and critical care doctor and faculty member at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. She is a former medical reporter for the Miami Herald and writes regularly for the New York Times. Welcome, Daniela, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our reviewer called your storytelling beautiful, and I agree. This is a book that's very compellingly told and one that is conscious of a narrative arc. So I'd like to begin by talking about the narrative of your medical career. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your mindset as a new doctor in treating critical care patients?
Sure, love to. So I started medicine essentially because my father is a doctor, and I have a lot of doctors in my family, and they always billed it to me as the only possible career. And while I thought of having other ones, it's sort of hard to ignore those voices. And so when I ended up in medical school and then residency, I was ready to be excited. This was what I was supposed to be doing. And There were many aspects that were not at all exciting and made me wonder why I was there. But one thing that did captivate me was the intensive care unit. There, you know, we have rotations in medical school. I did sort of a shadowing internship and then an actual internship as an intern. And you work every day, but every fourth night you stay overnight. And it's really this period of time where you essentially feel kind of exiled from the outside world when you go home after a night shift. It's 11 a.m. and the rest of the world is moving on a different schedule than you are, and your entire world becomes this room, the intensive care unit, and it's very powerful. And sort of you're working with a team and you feel it, and rightly so in many ways, that all that matters is what happens there. And that, you know, you're making these important decisions and you can barely see, or I could barely see at least my own life beyond the 4-week rotation. And so it was not really possible for me to think of, you know, what happened to these patients, what happened to these families afterwards. The sort of being within it was so powerful and captivating. And that stuck with me and drove my decisions about what kind of fellowship I would pursue and what kind of doctor I wanted to be.
You write in the book, quote, "I became the resident who didn't let anyone die. People knew this. I was proud of it. And in many ways, I still am." What did you mean by that?
So quite literally, I remembered and I wrote this, just sort of remembering this conversation, that a co-resident of mine commented after one night, I had been on overnight and he had come in one morning, and there was a patient who, if you had a panel of 10 doctors, myself included, and had asked them, would this person be okay? And if you defined okay, even as narrowly and concretely as, will this person live to leave the intensive care unit? Everybody would say no. In the moment, in the night of taking care of this person, the idea of actually having those conversations with a family member probably didn't even occur to me. My thoughts were really, what can I do so that when my team comes in the morning, this person is not dead, and thus I have done a good job. So those kinds of, I'm thinking of one particular interaction, but there were many sort of interactions and moments like that. And in my residency, we were given a lot of autonomy as doctors in training, overnight particularly, during the day as well, but less so in the intensive care unit, but overnight particularly. And with that autonomy came a great sense of responsibility that you did not want somebody's ending to have happened just with you. And so that, drove my desire to do anything possible to have everyone alive in the morning.
In the introduction, you share the story of a 90-year-old patient who decides that he doesn't want all of the interventions that are possible to extend his life, and you take it kind of personally.
Yeah, I remembered him as well. I was pretty insulted. Maybe that's overly simplifying things, but yeah, I really felt that we must have done something wrong. Like there must have been something else that I could do. And if only I had framed it differently, if only I used the right words, if only my affect were better, if only I fed him better, something, he would have agreed with me, that my perspective was a perspective that he would have shared. And, it really was, it was one of the first patients. I mean, patients of mine had died before, definitely. But it had been because, there was, as I perceived it, no other choice. And seeing somebody who, we had potentially more interventions to offer, he sort of selected against them, and that was, his choice for the way he was going to spend his remaining time, sort of stayed with me and thinking about, how people ultimately choose to spend their time. In this book, I ultimately focus on people who have made decisions for aggressive care and for interventions, because I was really curious about, what happened to them afterwards? Because there's sort of an increasing focus today on patients like that patient in the introduction. And I wondered about the others. But yes, I think it while there's a lot more focus now on serious illness conversations and care at the end of life, I think still for junior doctors, and definitely for me, there was a clear ethos of the life or death, you know, being a success or failure paradigm. And that's not all wrong, but I think that's what I was getting at with that story.
Yeah. At what point did the paradigm begin to shift for you? A little bit away toward that resolute, you know, preserve at all costs.
Yeah. You know, I think for a lot of people, it probably shifts sooner than it did for me. But I took this a year between residency and fellowship. And during that year, I worked as an editorial fellow for the New England Journal of Medicine. And that went along with sort of to keep up my clinical skills. I also worked in an ICU four nights a month, so just this four night stretch. And then I would have my days attending editorial meetings and having the opportunity to do some writing myself. And so it was this really interesting juxtaposition of this really intense time in an intensive care unit at night, and then all of this stretch that I never had in residency during the day to be like, huh, how did that go? And what can I, you know, what can I think about, and how can I sort of make my understanding of what went on more nuanced? And so during that year, I did some sort of thinking and writing about end of life conversations for residents. And that sort of sparked my thinking that, you know, there was something more that was part of my job that I maybe hadn't been doing as well as I could. And then ultimately went on to fellowship. And there, for the first time, had more time than residents do to spend with families. We also ended up having some rotations in a long-term ventilator unit where we saw people who had made it out of the ICU but weren't okay. We got to spend some time with our families and, you know, really began to sort of flesh out my understanding of the longer-term effects of our interventions. So it's sort of a multi-step process.
Yeah. This was my introduction to the term chronic critical illness, which I found extremely helpful in thinking about what you're talking about. Could you define that for our listeners?
Sure, definitely. So if you think about the words chronic critical illness, it's kind of an oxymoron, right?
Like, right.
Something critical should be acute. But these are patients who essentially have survived an acute critical illness, so a big surgery, a catastrophic trauma, a horrible infection, something like that, and didn't die, but days, weeks, maybe even months have gone by, and they're still reliant on high-level medical technologies to stay alive. So the easiest kind of definition are these are patients who never are able to breathe on their own without needing a ventilator for a longer period of time, at least some hours during the day. Some of these patients end up making it home, but most of them don't. Most of them go to, at least from the acute care hospital, they go to something called a long-term acute care hospital. So another hospital where the length of stay is far longer. And the goal of that hospital is to get these patients to a point where they're able to get home. But of patients who meet that definition, in a year after that acute critical illness, half will be dead. So it's a very bad prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10%, so about 1 in 10, will be alive and independent at home. So that's that segment of patients.
It was also interesting to me to learn that there is actually a specific type of post-traumatic stress disorder that some people receiving these high-level, you know, interventions experience, you know, post-intervention.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. Myself, I'm happy to opine on it, but yeah.
Go ahead. Let's do it.
So basically, you know, this was something as well that I wasn't aware of in residency. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One, sort of the description and the understanding of these long-term effects of critical illness are really just kind of capturing the sort of body of critical care research. And from that way, they still have to make their way out kind of to the public. And so it just wasn't as known. But also, you know, critical care generally had gauged its successes and failures in mortality, time on the ventilator, you know, 1 week, 30, 60, 90 days, these sorts of things. And so looking at these sort of more nuanced effects of critical illness just hadn't happened till, you know, sort of recent years. And so one of the things that people have found is that The ICU, it's a traumatic experience. It's a raw trauma. As a result of that, people can suffer post-traumatic stress from an intensive care unit stay. And that post-traumatic stress often sort of takes the forms of, flashbacks and nightmares, as does PTSD to any trauma, war, something like this. But part of the trauma of an ICU is often linked to delirium. And to these terrifying, delirious kind of hallucinations that people have while they're in the ICU, often of really disturbing things of the mind just trying to make sense of what's going on. People envision themselves being sexually abused. They envision these paranoid plots going on. And sometimes these are the things to which they will have the flashbacks and nightmares afterwards.
I'm wondering, because it's a compelling book, it's beautifully written, but it's not a book that necessarily gives a lot of easy answers. But I did want to ask you, are there specific things we can do to be better patients for ourselves, to make more informed decisions about our own care?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I know thinking about the book and trying, and some people ask, oh, what's your book about? I'm not a prescriptive person really at all.
Yeah.
My goal was really to tell stories that people didn't see. So I think though that if I had to sort of offer something to people, which I would like to do, I think it's important to gather all the possible information. And by that, I mean, try to understand, I work, as I write in this book, in this pre-transplant clinic. And I think the best things that people can do are to try to be realistic about the range of outcomes that they might face. But also to know that what people end up being able to tolerate is really different than what they might have thought at first, and that these decisions, even the process of informed consent, it's all a process, and you can't make these decisions at one time. And often you have to, right? Like there's an acute event, and you make a decision, or a decision is made for you. But there are opportunities sort of down the road to reassess, and that if there has been a decision made, that you can. You can reassess. And I think it's really important for patients, family members, to work with their doctors to say, like, what's the best and worst case scenario of this? What kind of time course will I see that happening in? And revisit, if they say the best case scenario is that you'll be home in 6 months' time, and 6 months passes and you're no closer to home, and the state that you're in is one that would not be tolerable if it never got you home. I think being really clear about that, as clear as it's possible to be, talking to your family and really being realistic about what might be able to happen, is probably the best kind of things that we can do as we're put in positions that nobody really can imagine up front until they're in it.
If you have time for one more closing question, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about this book?
I think what I'd like listeners to know, what I was surprised by, is that, I began thinking that I would track these people, some of whom were my patients, most of whom were not, out of the hospital, and I would find that they were unhappy, or that their lives were more complicated in negative ways than they had thought. And what I ultimately found, and I didn't, try to find the optimistic stories, although clearly there's some bias in who would talk to me, what I found really amazed me in terms of what people can go through and how, where people find meaning and enjoyment. And the stories that I tell are not intended to be stories that say this is the way it should be. Like in each story, I think it would be appropriate for somebody to have chosen a different path. But that's not the path that people I picked chose. But I essentially just want people to read these stories and say, is this something I would find tolerable? And perhaps if they're faced with these decisions, or their loved ones are at some points in their lives, they could reflect on some of these stories, and it might just make them a little bit more prepared for what might be likely to be ahead.
Hopefully our listeners will get to share these stories with you. The book is called You Can Stop Humming Now, A Doctor's Stories of Life, Death, and In Between. Dr. Daniela Lamas, thank you very much for joining us on Fully Booked.
Oh my gosh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Ratza is a Chicago author who has degrees from Illinois Institute of Technology, University of Chicago, the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, and Greenwich University. And he's taught business at DePaul University, among other institutions. His debut sci-fi thriller, The Girl with the Lightning Brain, tells the story of Electra Kit Kittner, born in the year 2097, who survived a lightning strike as an infant that killed both of her biotechnologist parents. They and their team are working on a vaccine to counter the techno plague, which has rampaged across Earth, causing dementia-like symptoms in its victims. Now in 2115, 18-year-old Kit has a genius intellect, a deep interest in religion and philosophy, and superior strength and agility that she's kept under wraps, but she soon puts them into action to fight terrorists, among other things. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Cliff about the book, which Kirkus Indies reviewer called incisive and profound. Cliff, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you very much.
So you have a background in math and physics, business, and computer science, and this book tackles a wide range of other subjects, including religion, philosophy, biology. In the appendix, you even include a chart, an explanation of how the techno plague works. And so I was wondering, were these fields personal interests of yours?
So I have a wide range of interests supported by degrees and working in these fields in my business career. So it seemed natural to me to write a book on a topic I'm interested in that ties all these disciplines together.
So the novel, it jumps around in time between different time periods, including the beginning of the plague and around the time of Electra's birth and the present day in 2115. And I was just wondering, what made you decide to structure the book this way, and how does it help you to better tell the story?
The book is deliberately written into three storyline threads, and they are all interwoven together. I do this to maintain the reader's interest, first in knowing what's happening right now at the start of the book, and showing how the action in the past, how it all ties together.
Kind of interesting. You could include a lot of detail in your world building. For example, there's a sports league called the Co-NFL, a CrossFit football combo that features male and female athletes, you know, other things of that nature. And I was wondering, how much time did you spend developing the world of the novel?
Everything in the book, the science, for example, is not science fiction. It's science fact projected into the future. I've done the same thing with some of my, you know, creative elements of lifestyles in the future. The co-NFL is just one of them, as is the marriage practice in the future. We have marriages, but it's called a vow ceremony.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us about your novel, The Girl with the Lightning Brain, Cliff. If you're just joining the podcast, you can find Cliff Ratza's The Girl with the Lightning Brain at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other online bookstores. And it's available in ebook and paperback.
I'm so glad you asked about what patients can do, because our health, you know, the American healthcare system is just so baffling. And her response, you know, to be realistic, I mean, it's not exactly what you want to hear, but it's really good advice, I feel like.
I agree. And it's really interesting because she's recounting these stories in the book. And as she says, most of the patients in here were not her own. But she indicates that it's maybe not always the right time when somebody has just been through like an acute event to say, but be realistic about this, but that, but think about how hard your recovery will be. You know, these are things to consider when you're able. But when you're able, it's very important. I've already started having conversations with my family about what level of care they might like should something like this happen. I think it's important to know.
Yeah. Tough conversations, but it's much tougher if you don't have them, right?
Right.
All right. So turning to other books, big bestsellers, let's call up the editors to see which books they are liking.
It's our favorite time on Fully Booked, where our editors join us for their number one picks for the week. We have children's editor Vicki Smith, YA editor Laura Simeon, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Our nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau is out of the office this week. Hello, Vicki. What's your number one pick in children's literature?
I've actually cut kind of a matched pair.
Oh.
A book from 2016 has been on the bestseller list for the past couple of weeks. It's The Wild Robot by Peter Brown. And it is a perfectly adorable and at the same time very smart story about a super intelligent robot named Roz who is sort of shipwrecked on an island that's inhabited only by animals. And in the first book, she very carefully observes and learns the habits of the animals. She learns their language. She is not represented as, you know, innately emotional, but she clearly develops emotion. And it's a really delightful story watching her sort of figure out how to live with these new companions that she was absolutely not designed to live with. But nevertheless, because she was built to help, that is the destiny that she seeks to fulfill in this new and unexpected environment. and it's a really lovely book. I highly recommend it. And the sequel has just come out, The Wild Robot Escapes. And I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail about it because people who haven't read the first book and want to read the first book before they read the second book, I want to protect them from spoilers. But I think that having the first book on the bestseller list is clearly, you know, sort of leading people to this second book. And I think that readers who take both of them on will not be disappointed.
Okay, so that's super exciting. Two for one this week in Children's Lit. All right. Thank you, Vicki.
Sure.
Turning now to YA. Hi, Laura. What's your pick for us this week?
So my pick for this week is a new book by Jessica Verdi, who's a Brooklyn YA author. It's her fourth novel, and it's called And She Was. And this is about an 18-year-old girl named Dara, who is a very talented tennis player, and her coach tells her it's time to go pro. And this means travel to international tournaments, which means you need a passport, which means you need a birth certificate. So this is where the plot thickens. Yes. Dara's mother says, sorry, I've lost your birth certificate. I guess he can't go. So Dara, of course, starts digging around at home and she finds a box of documents. It turns out that her mother died when she was an infant. And the person she thinks is her mother was actually her father, who has transitioned. And so surprise plot. Not a spoiler because it happens early enough on. Book is really about she goes on this road trip, find family, kind of in search of answers. And then this series of emails between her and her mother kind of fills in what happened and why. And it's a beautiful book. There's complex, you know, characters, a lot of respect by the author for every character. A reviewer wrote, Verdi's book is a triumph, an exquisite mirror in which trans parents and their children will see themselves. And for once, the reflection won't break their hearts.
I really want to read that.
Yes, you should.
All right. So, Laurie, what is going on in fiction? What are we liking?
Well, a book called The Kremlin's Candidate by Jason Matthews, which... you might know about because you interviewed him a few weeks ago. For anybody who missed that installation of the podcast, I wanted to recommend this. Also, you might know it because there's a movie. This is the third and last volume in a series that Matthews has written. And the first book in the series, Red Sparrow, just came out as a movie with Jennifer Lawrence. So Matthews was a CIA officer for 33 years, and this is a sort of traditional spy versus spy novel. His character, Dominika Egorova, is a very high up Russian intelligence officer who is a US counter spy, double agent. And in this installment, she is looking for her counterpart, who is a very high up American intelligence operative who's kind of gunning to become director of the CIA, who is actually a Russian mole. So it's spy versus spy. Our reviewer says that Matthew's vast experience working in the espionage world lends great authenticity to his books. And also he's a really good writer, which doesn't hurt. So the books are really fun. Of course, the title, The Kremlin's Candidate, feels like it couldn't be more timely, but it doesn't have anything to do with what you think it might have to do with in terms of current events. It's not about the people at the top of the governments of these two countries, but about their spies grappling with each other.
Spy versus spy. I love that
kind of story. Spy versus spy. Yeah.
Nice. Okay, well, thank you.
Sure.
So, everybody, we hope you join us next week. You know what to do. Turn this thing off. and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
True crime fans rejoice. Small Town Murder is now on Podcast One. Crime and Sports' James Petragallo and Jimmy Wissman look at small towns, what makes them tick, and the murders that took place there. In-depth research, horrible tragedy, and the host's comedic spin on the whole thing. What can go wrong? Subscribe to hear new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.